for climate justice. They were fighting for climate justice before we started calling it climate justice. And I've learned so much from them over the years. And in fact, Henry was really one of the people who inspired me to write my last book, The Shock Doctrine, because he was organizing against the seizing of land in the aftermath of the Asian tsunami in 2004, immediately after, when land was being grabbed and given over to industrial fishing and fishing ports and hotel developers in Indonesia and Thailand and Sri Lanka. It was Via Campesina and really Henry himself who brought people together in the immediate aftermath to make sure that people were able to respond even as they were reeling from crisis. And now, of course, we're facing another kind of colonial land grab on a much, much larger scale. But it's an important reminder that we've been doing this for a while now, fighting against the privatization of life itself. This is what the movement that many of us have been a part of now for more than a decade have been fighting for, fighting to protect that which is too important to be left to the market. That's what we were doing 10 years ago on the streets of Seattle, and that's what we were doing before September 11th, when so much of our movement was derailed and we started fighting rear guard actions against wars and torture and battles that we thought we'd won. But in many ways, our movement is coming full circle. We're continuing that conversation that was so rudely interrupted, but we're also deepening that conversation and we're learning from our mistakes. I feel a bit funny kicking off this incredible forum. I'm not an expert on climate science. I do know a little something about corporations and their tendency to take advantage of crises and disasters. And I do think that what we're seeing at the Bella Center is the biggest case of disaster capitalism that we have ever witnessed. The profiteering And it is sad that this summit has turned into far more of that than what we would all want it to be. I got lost coming here. There was this huge concert. There was a giant earth inflated with a huge Siemens logo on it. I thought that was appropriate. It's very strange. I just arrived in Copenhagen today, and it's a strange feeling because on one level, it's so exciting that the whole world is talking about climate change, and at the very highest levels of power, there appears to be some kind of a consensus about the problem. And every bus shelter has an advertisement, and even the fact that there are these concerts outside, and this is what the world is talking about, and it's all emanating from this city. But then there's this strange dissonance, because we remember that despite the fact that we are all seemingly agreeing, denialists aside, and we have all of this urgency, and we've been told again and again this is the last chance to save the Earth and all of this rhetoric, we know that what is being proposed in the Bella Center does not come close to addressing the climate crisis. It's not on the table. We have to be realistic about that. I think the time for naivete is really over. Just sitting here and hoping and praying for a deal that is not on the table is silly. We know what's on the table. We know the paltry emission cuts that the Obama administration is talking about. 17% below 2005 levels, when science calls for 40% below 1990 levels. We know the levels of funding that they're talking about for climate, deeply climate-affected countries, and they're insulting. They're insulting because we, in the rich world, are the ones who created this crisis. And on the most basic principle of polluter pays, or as Colin Powell liked to say before the invasion of Iraq, you broke it, you bought it. This is not about charity. This is not about more aid for the needy in Africa. This is about a crisis that we created through our consumption. 75% of the historical emissions that created the climate crisis came from 20% of the world's population in the developed world, in the industrialized world. According to the World Bank, hardly a radical source, 75% of the effects of climate change are being felt in the developing world. So there is a direct inverse relationship between cause and effect, between where the crisis was created and where the effects of the crisis are being felt. And then we come here, our governments come here, and talk about giving the levels of funding that AIG finds, you know, loose in the couch as some sort of a favor to the needy. And this is the conversation that we need to change. This cannot be discussed as some kind of charitable giving. The other thing that I'm having a little bit of trouble with here in Copenhagen is this whole Hopenhagen thing. How are you guys feeling about this? The hope, sponsored by Coca-Cola, of course. Yeah, I'm uneasy about it. I'm uneasy about it because we have just gone through this mass marketing of hope in the United States, and the whole world was roped into the Obama branding campaign. And you know, I'm a fan of hope. I like hope. But I have something, I call it a hope over. It's a hope hangover. From this particular kind of corporate hope that we all got such a large dose of. And what I don't like about it is I don't like the effect that that kind of hope has, this sort of messianic hope has on our movements, on social movements. Because we go into this strange state of waiting, of constantly waiting for the magic to happen. You know, and the awarding of a Nobel Prize was a big part of that, this pre-prize. And we're talking a lot about carbon sinks and carbon storage and sequestration, and I think there's some sort of weird analogy maybe that we can draw with what is happening to hope, that hope is being sequestered, and this whole marketing of hope by Obama and the transformation of Copenhagen to Hopenhagen, it's like some big, great hope sink, you know? It's sucking up all the hope and keeping our movements immobilized while we wait. But what's exciting about what's been happening over the past couple of months is that people are waking up out of this sort of hope stupor. And we're seeing another kind of hope emerge from the grassroots. Studs Terkel, the great oral historian who died a year ago, he wrote a book called Hope Dies Last. And the first line of the book is, hope is never handed down. It always trickles up. And we're starting to see that kind of hope again. And a lot of people have drawn comparisons between this moment, the moment that we find ourselves in here in Copenhagen and around the world watching Copenhagen, as being somewhat similar to the feeling in the air before those protests in Seattle exactly 10 years ago, when a new convergence, a movement of movement, was finding itself. We were finding each other. And what was unique about that moment was not that the movement was new, it was that it was many movements. It was this movement of movement. And in many ways, we had the World Trade Organization to thank for it because it was so ambitious. It reached into all of these sectors that had previously just organized on their own and didn't feel like they had to make coalitions or often had been pitted against each other, like the environment and labor. That's what was special about Seattle, the Teamsters and Turtles Coalition. And it was the ambition of the WTO that brought those coalitions together. And it also pushed us to go beyond our single issues and to talk about economic systems, to talk about models. And there were debates at the time about whether you could even say the word capitalism. right? Call it corporate globalization. We'll say capitalism, it'll freak people out and the funders will cut their funding, right? So there were big debates about that, and there was a piece of graffiti in Washington, D.C., outside a meeting of the IMF when there were big protests a couple of months after Seattle. Some anarchists wrote, "If you think globalization is bad, wait till you hear about capitalism." And so it was all this coded language. And the truth was, it was a tough time to be criticizing capitalism. I mean, think about it, Seattle, 1999. This is the height of the dot-com frenzy, and this was ground zero. This was boomtown. This was Bill Gates' hometown. And here were all these kids in black going, "We don't think it's working out that great." People thought that this movement was off the wall. Thomas Friedman referred to us as flat earthers, and that was before he wrote a book saying that the world is flat. So now we have a very, very different moment. Capitalism is on trial in so many ways. There is more distrust of this economic system than there has been at any point since the Great Depression. And in particular, there is a massive amount of distrust of the casino economy, of precisely the types of mechanisms that are being put forward at the Bella Center as the solution to the climate crisis. So, in other words, it's not that easy a time to be the ones trying to sell these so-called market-based solutions after precisely these types of complex financial instruments melted down the global financial system, and after we all saw what betting on commodity prices does to the price of food. Hey, let's do it to carbon, that'll be fun, right? It's a hard time to be then, but what has really been striking over the past year is that at the same time as public opinion shifted, not to where we were 10 years ago, but beyond that, with these open critiques of capitalism, where was the movement? Where was the mass movement that was responding to it? And that is what is changing now, because finally we're seeing the movement. And it's focused precisely on these false solutions, these market-based solutions, the insanity after what we've just witnessed of handing over the most pressing, challenging, terrifying crisis that humanity has ever faced to the very same people that created that crisis, that gambled away people's jobs and homes and pensions. So we have, I think, a very, very exciting moment. And it's important to be the truth tellers in this moment, to be the lie detectors when we hear that there's a deal, because there will be a deal, because the brave negotiators are all being sidelined and pressured, and they'll still take some stands, but I doubt we'll even see the kind of bravery that we saw just now in Barcelona and Bangkok in the pre-negotiations, because so much pressure to get a deal is already underway, and Obama wouldn't be coming if they didn't think they already had a deal. But we are the ones who have to be clear on the difference between a deal and success. A deal are, you know, a couple of major emitters meeting in a back room and saying, "I agree to let you off the hook if you agree to let me off the hook." That's a deal. Yeah. And these meetings have their own momentum. The momentum is get the deal no matter what the cost is. And then the negotiators claim success. So we have to be the ones who are the lie detectors here. One of the things that's going to happen in the next couple of days is that the WTO caravan that started in Geneva has been making its way to Copenhagen will arrive. And, you know, this is really making, with their bodies, with their travels, the connections that we know and feel between the movement that so many of us were a part of, challenging the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, and the underlying system of global capitalism at its root. Because it isn't just about the market-based solutions to climate change that are the problem. It's that whole economic model. When you look at what they're actually, and Henry talked about this, in terms of what the agricultural policies that the World Trade Organization is pushing and the absolute inconsistency of those policies with anything that this meeting is supposed to be achieving. But think about the whole model of trade that the World Trade Organization has championed all of these years. It's producing the goods as far as possible from where they're consumed and hauling them on emission-spewing freighters to Copenhagen, to where I live, Toronto. It is the most carbon-intensive way to run an economy that you could possibly imagine. It's inconsistent with any solutions, real solutions, that we are going to be talking about here in the next 2 weeks. And another example is the TRIPS, the intellectual property rights system that the World Trade Organization pioneered. Think about what that system did to the dissemination of life-saving AIDS drugs. Well, what is the system there to do? It's there to protect intellectual property so that it can be profitable for corporations. It's very, very clear. And we saw the kind of apartheid system that was created for access to drugs. The same thing will be created unless that system is challenged with regards to green technologies. I mean, we can talk all we want about technology transfers, but unless we are challenging TRIPS, there's not going to be technology transfers on that scale. It's illegal to do what we're talking about. So we have to bring these conversations together. We have to bring all of our movements together. One of the things that's changed from 10 years ago is 10 years ago, we were the ones saying no. You know, we often quoted quoted Subcomandante Marcos' phrase, one no and many yeses. But the fact is, we were saying no to the World Trade Organization, we were saying no to the IMF, the World Bank, the G8. I make no apologies for that. Here in Copenhagen, we have a different situation, because many of us here believe in the basic principles of the Climate Convention. We agree with what this meeting is supposed to be, what is supposed to be on paper, and let's remember that the very fact that there ever was an Earth Summit was the result of an activist win. Activists won that grew out of the environmental movement. So we aren't the ones saying no. In fact, we're the ones saying yes. And our task is to reveal the elites, the corporate and political elites, as the ones who are the naysayers, are really the Luddites, who don't want to transform, don't want to change, don't want to adapt. So this is something that is a very big difference. And the other difference is, I think, the confidence with which our movement is proposing solutions. Confident because in so many ways they're the same solutions that we've been talking about for so many years. But there are also some exciting new ideas floating around. New is relative, of course. But the alternative that I'm finding most inspiring and I think has the most potential to take our movement forward is the idea of climate debt and the fact that the rich world must pay reparations for the creation of the climate crisis. Now, I've already talked about those statistics that we know that the rich world is responsible for 75% of the historical emissions and 75% of the effects of those emissions are being felt in the developing world. So how do you repay a debt like that? Well, the position of the Bolivian government, and they have backing from the Coalition of Least Developed Countries as well as other countries, is that it's very clear. You pay this debt in three ways. One, through very deep emissions cuts, by creating atmospheric space, freeing up atmospheric space for the countries that have emitted the least and need some of that cheap fuel in order to develop. So it's not about just splitting the difference the way it's been formulated here. We'll cut some, poor countries will cut some. It's about rich countries cutting very, very deeply in response to this historical debt, the fact that we have taken up so much more of our share of a limited resource. There is a global carbon budget. We are way over it. The other response, the other way you pay a debt is you pay it. You pay it with money. And there's two areas in which we need to pay it. One is helping countries to adapt to the reality of climate change that is already underway. That means responding to droughts. That means building flood walls. That just is the direct response to the way in which the climate is already changing. The World Bank estimates that developing countries are facing costs of $100 billion a year just adapting to current climate change. We can debate those numbers. It's the World Bank, so you can assume that it's low. A team of UN scientists added what it would cost not just to respond to the reality of climate change, but to leapfrog over fossil fuels and adopt green technologies, green energy. And they put that figure at $500 to $600 billion a year. So it's a lot, but still not coming anywhere near the levels of funding that the banks got. So that's the debt. But what's exciting about this, and why it really is the embodiment of the idea of climate justice, is that, you know, we hear a lot about this idea of win-win solutions to climate change. That's the phrase you're constantly hearing from green entrepreneurs. You know, we can get rich and save the planet at the same time. Well, I think we're all a little skeptical about that. But this is the real win-win. Because this is the way we get off the carbon path and we tackle the deep inequalities that cleave our world at the same time. We're talking about a massive transfer of wealth from north to south. Angelica Navarro, the Bolivian climate negotiator, calls it a Marshall Plan for planet Earth. Because, of course, we all benefit from that leapfrogging over fossil fuels. And these debts are long overdue. They are not just about the latest calculations around climate debt. So many debts are owed from the north to the south and have gone unpaid. Debts for colonial pillage, for slavery. Economists, political scientists have been making the case for years to no avail, but the case for climate debt is stronger than any of these other historical debts before, and that's because 192 countries signed the Climate Convention in 1992 that recognized the principle of historical responsibility, that rich countries, Annex I countries, have a historical responsibility to cut their emissions and pay the costs of adapting to climate change. So there's actually a document, and there is basic principle of polluter pays, which is a familiar principle. So this is a winnable case. I want to talk a little bit about my own country briefly, because I think it points to where this movement needs to go in terms of getting stronger. Because we can gather here and we can make these arguments, and there are going to be some incredible sessions here at Clima Forum on ecological debt and climate debt and moving towards a people's tribunal. And one of the things that I find really interesting in talking about climate debt is that very few people will even debate it because the case is so strong. But the reason why it isn't getting more attention is because the response is really, what are you going to do about it? Where is your power? You've got a case, you've got a strong legal case, but how are you going to enforce these debts? And, you know, if you look at the country where I am from, Canada, and, you know, it's pretty embarrassing to do that. I used to be a little bit proud to be Canadian. You know, we used to sew maple leaves on our backpacks and all that. You don't want to do that in Copenhagen this week. In many ways, Canada is worse than the United States because the U.S. never signed the Kyoto Agreement. Canada did. Canada signed the Kyoto Protocol, agreed to emission targets, and has been flouting them with impunity, absolutely recklessly. We have increased our emissions from 1990 levels by 26%. The reason for that is very clear. Canada discovered oil. By discovered, I mean we always had it, but it was so expensive to extract it that it wasn't even counted as part of the world oil reserves. Here I'm referring to the Alberta tar sands. After the war in Iraq, the price of oil skyrocketed. And suddenly it became profitable for companies like Shell and BP to make major investments, boiling the earth in Alberta, turning tar into liquid form, taking three times as much fossil fuel energy in order to do it as it takes to extract a regular barrel of crude. So that's why our emissions are up almost 30% from 1990 levels. And what's interesting about it is the way our government sells this to Canadians. It says, you know, Canadians are concerned about the environment like everybody else is, but we're told by our government that if we don't do this, if we don't continue with the tar sands, then our economy will be hurt. There will be consequences. Whereas if we continue with this environmental atrocity, what happens? Nothing. Is there any trade retaliation? I mean, think about the World Trade Organization. What happens when you break one of their little rules? Canada was targeted because we banned an additive in gasoline. We were sued. Why are there no consequences to breaking these agreements? Our governments have failed, and they will fail. They're not going to enforce these agreements. But we know how to do this. Boycotts, sanctions, divestment. Sound familiar, anyone? I feel as a Canadian that this needs to happen to my country. This needs to happen to my country because the government that is doing this, our Tory government, they're doing it with a minority. They don't even have a majority in Parliament. They have a minority. And they could very well get a majority if they keep getting rewarded for this type of behavior, if there are no consequences. So these are the types of actions that I think everything should be on the table. Everything should be on the table. Now, I want to just close briefly by talking a little bit about tactics. Because I know there's lots of debates going on within the movement about what types of tactics to use in the next few days, in the next couple of weeks. Our movement is changing, it's evolving, we're learning from past mistakes. And I think we must. I think we have to deprive the corporate media of their insatiable hunger for turning a story that is about the world versus COP15 and its failures into a story about activists versus cops. That's not the story. As a rule, our actions should embody the future that we want. Democratic, respectful of one another, and not to get too flaky, filled with love for the movement that we're trying to build, for the communities that we're trying to protect and transform. I firmly believe that, but I also believe this. Rage has a place here, and we mustn't forget it. What we are witnessing at the Bella Center is an almost unbelievable betrayal of past promises, like the ones my country has made, of past treaties, which have been made a mockery of. And then there is the betrayal that Barack Obama represents, not just a betrayal of his own voters, but of the incredible hope and faith that was placed in him by the whole world. I don't think Barack Obama is the worst US president by any means. I think he's way better than most. But I have certainly never witnessed a US president blow as many once in a generation opportunities as this US president. He has blown so many opportunities in his 1 year that it is absolutely unforgivable, and he needs to hear from the world. He needs to hear from the world here. He had a historic democratic mandate for change. He was given a blank check to stimulate the U.S. economy. He could have spent it however he wanted to. He spent most of it on tax cuts and reinvesting in the car economy and highways. He shortchanged public transit on a massive scale. Oh, and the other thing he had in the palm of his hands when he took office was the entire financial sector. In the palm of his hands, they owned it if they wanted it. That means they could have asked anything of these banks that they controlled, including that they direct their lending to a transformation of the economy. It could have happened. It didn't happen. They lost the moment. This is a massive betrayal. It doesn't happen a lot. It hasn't happened since the 30s. It's not going to happen again soon. And we cannot let this pass. We have a right to be angry. We have a responsibility to be angry. Rage is an appropriate response to what is going on right now with this failure. Now, we channel that rage intelligently. We are smart. We are tactical. But if we try to erase that rage, we become part of the problem. Because how else will the world know how serious this failure is if we restrict ourselves to formulaic marches and polite panel discussions? It's not enough. We show the stakes of this struggle with our willingness to take risks. It has always been thus. Let us not belittle the fine tradition of civil disobedience. My friend John Jordan, who's here, he's one of the mad inventors behind the soon-to-be-unveiled bike block. I was talking to him the other day, and he described Copenhagen as, he said, if Seattle was the movement's coming out party, Copenhagen will be its coming of age. But he added this, I hope we have grown up to become much more disobedient, because life on this world of ours may well be terminated because of too many acts of obedience. Now, I know many of you, like John, arrived here by some creative carbon neutral means. Maybe you biked, maybe you boated, maybe you took solar-powered buses. I'm ashamed to admit that I didn't swim here from Canada. I contributed to my country's already grotesque carbon footprint. I booked my ticket a couple of months ago, back when there was still a glimmer of hope about what the official summit could produce. I admit that I got sucked into it. And as the standards for success lowered and then lowered some more, I actually thought a few times about canceling, whether it was worth the carbon that I was going to be emitting in order to come here. And I even thought maybe all of us who are flying here should just cancel. Maybe that should be our act of disobedience. Why were thousands of us burning fossil fuels to get here and resolve to do next to nothing? But here we are, at a conference that was billed as the last chance to save the world, and which has been announced as a failure before it began. We have to somehow offset the carbon we emitted coming here. How do we do it? We do it, or we try to do it, by using this incredible space, this historic convergence, to build the kind of global mass movement that will never, ever let our leaders get away with this kind of criminal negligence again. That is our task, my friends. It is awesome and fearsome. Think of it as the mother of all carbon offsets. Thank you.